Thank you. My name is Aubrey Hayes. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very, very grateful, alcoholic. Grateful to be here and grateful to be alive. I was asked to make a talk many years ago, and I said, what am I supposed to talk about? And they said, well, just tell them what it was like when you were drinking and how you found AA and what it's been like since you found AA. And so that's what I did that night, and I've never found a better outline for a talk. And most of the people that I hear who make talks, either consciously or subconsciously, follow that sort of thing, no matter how new they are or how old they are or how many talks they've made or anything like that. I was real nervous the first time that I talked, and it kind of put me in mind of a story that was in the grapevine about a month ago. It said this guy walked into an AA club, and he had a hook on his hand, and he had a patch over one eye. Fellow said, what happened? Said, how did you lose your hand? He said, oh, I lost that over in Korea. He said, you lose your eye too? And he said, no. He said, how'd you lose that? He said, a gnat flew in it. He said, a gnat flew in it. He said, yeah. He said, that was the first day I had the hook. We all have to get used to things. It was hard for me to get used to staying sober. I tell you, it was the hardest thing in the world for me to get used to staying sober. I didn't start out in life drunk. I started out in life sober. My folks were good people. They were church people, and my grandfather and great-grandfather and great-uncle were all three Methodist preachers at one time in the North Georgia Methodist Conference. And my grandfather had no sons. He had four daughters, and he had a couple of grandsons. And when I was little, I told him, I want to be a preacher. I want to be a preacher like you, Bob. That's what we all call him, Bob. We could say Grandpa. And everybody in the family got to using that same name. And he gave me a Bible, and then he had written to my preacher boy. And when I was coming up in life, Mother was a preacher's daughter, and she was always had a spit and polished and shined and said in Sunday school every time, some church, every time, about three times a week, sometimes. And
I thought I can bounce now.
Okay. And so I grew up with a strong concept of what was right and wrong, or at least what my family thought was right and wrong, and what the big book says is right and wrong. And I was all through high school, I was the kind of fellow, I was playing athletics. My dad had played football over at Alabama when they had the first Rose Bowl team, and he was a professional baseball pitcher, and he had me interested in athletics. And I was the kind of fellow that on the football field, if somebody said a bad word, I'd stop them, I'd correct them. And we'd walk out behind the gym a lot of times and settle it. And that was how strong I felt. I was in the Scouts. I got to be an Eagle Scout, president of the Methodist Youth Fellowship. And one night, about my senior year, we rode out, some fellows and I, we didn't have dates or anything, we were in a car, and we rode out between this two little towns out there, and it was a roadhouse out there, and one of the fellows knew the fellow that ran it, and he went inside and he got a couple of us of Coke and got himself a beer. And he said, do you want to swallow? And I didn't want to look like a chicken. He was an older guy. He was a World War II vet. He'd gotten out and gotten in. I didn't want to look like a... So I took a swallow. And the next night or two later, we rode out there again, and one of the fellows and I split a beer. And about two or three nights later, we went back out there, and I ordered one just for myself. And about three nights later, it was my idea to go. And from that beginning... With the beer and what it did for me, my whole life changed. It was never, ever the same again. It just had an effect on me. It changed my life. It made me, I lost a lot of my inhibitions. I felt camaraderie with other people. We'd get half tight and sing All these old songs, harmonized and everything like that. A lot of young folks in that town, we'd park out on the bridge near town on the road where there wasn't much traffic and turn the car radios on and dance on the bridge and drink beer and things like this. And this is what sort of started it. I got in some trouble with the law, and it wasn't bad trouble. It wasn't anything I really did. But it was a scandalous kind of thing in that little town, because it was a real straight-laced little old town, and my granddaddy having been a preacher there and everything like that, I felt like I disgraced myself and the whole family. And the drinking became a better thing for me then, because when I took a drink, I forgot about all that. I didn't feel inhibited. And then my folks moved. Dad went in business in another town. We moved to Savannah, larger town. And when I got there, I became worried that the people in Savannah, the friends I made, would find out about this trouble I'd been in the other town and in the drinking. And the people that I was introduced to, there were a lot of, Savannah had a lot of things they called tea dances, where they had young folks there, and they spiked the punch. It was champagne punch or something. It wasn't real strong stuff, but they had the young folks were drinking at a pretty early age, and it was pretty well accepted there to do that. And I used to spend more time near the punch bowl than I did dancing. I got to thinking about it one time, and you know, when I first started out, and the only reason I'm telling you this, I don't want to get in a long drunk log, but the big book says that the most valuable thing we have when we come into AA is maybe some of the worst things we ever did, our drinking experiences. And I'm just saying this for purposes of identification. And in my story and how I found AA and how I worked this program and everything like that, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. I'm going to tell you how I did it. And if there's anybody here that can identify with that and can follow along with that, I can only tell you that it worked for me. But at that particular time, I was a pretty confused young man. The effect of the liquor and what it did for me, but I also remember the empty feeling and waking up the next morning and being in an entirely different situation, you know, with your money depleted and probably several embarrassing things that you'd done. And this is before it got really bad, but it was something that started out sort of on the circumference. It was something that sort of went along with the dance. If they had something to drink at the dance, you drank. Or if you went to a football game and somebody happened to have a pint and wanted to spike the Coke or something like that and pass the Coke along the line and it spiked the Coke or something like that. And it was something that sort of went along with it. And if they had something there, fine. If it didn't, fine. But then it evolved into where I wouldn't go to a dance unless there was liquor there, unless I knew there was liquor there. I wouldn't go to a football game unless I knew that there was going to be liquor there. I wouldn't associate with people unless they drank. I got more and more, it got more and more into the center of my life. From the circumference, it worked its way right into the center of my life. To the point that when I finally got out of college and took a job, I got into sales. And I used all the usual excuses with my family why I did that instead of going into something maybe a little more substantial. And told them what it was because I liked people, I liked to meet people, and et cetera, but it was really because, as a salesperson, you could be outside, and people couldn't watch you, and they didn't know what you did, especially if you were a traveling salesman. I mean, you got out on the road, if you wrote enough business in a couple of days, you could take a day off and drink. And this was the thing that I liked so much about the type of work that I did. That's why I got into it, why I stayed into it for a number of years. In Savannah, I began to foul up more and more. Began to get traffic tickets and began to get in fights. Began to argue and see things differently than my mother and dad. Began to get a peculiar kind of resentment. I thought, boy, what a terrible thing that they've raised me up in this moralistic, legalistic type of a house where my conscience has to hurt me when I do something and other people's don't seem to bother them. I had friends who drank, who could get drunk and do a lot of worse things than I did, but they'd wake up in the morning and laugh about it, and I'm over in the corner holding my head. why in the world did I do that? And then I got, the morning drinking came on as a result of feeling a lot of that. And finally it got to the point I couldn't get along with it anymore. And along with my athletics, which I had passed by the board, along with my drinking, the more my drinking progressed, the less I got interested in ever playing anymore. Well, I had been active in music. And so I decided to go to New York and pursue that career. And went to New York. And at the time that I went up there, I knew nobody. I knew one name of a music teacher that had taught a lady that I knew in Savannah who worked for a radio station where I had a program. And I got up there and I was as green as anybody had ever been. I got off the train at Penn Station and I'd heard different musicians that would come through Savannah talk about Greenwich Village. And I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a little town up there somewhere near New York. I didn't have any idea what it was. And I got in a cab and I asked this guy, a cab driver, I said, "Do you know where Greenwich Village is?" And he turned the line and looked at me kind of strange. He said, "Yeah." And he took me on a tour of the five boroughs of New York, you know, getting me from Penn Station down there. It was about a $40 cab ride, a $50 cab ride time I got there. And he let me out in front of the real estate office, and I asked the fellow at the real estate office if he knew I could get a room. And he helped me carry my bags down the street, a couple suitcases down the street to a little three-story building. And a little Italian landlady there, and she rented me a room for $15 a week. It was a third floor walk-up. And took my bags up there, and as soon as I got them unpacked, I'd seen my mother and dad move to new towns. I didn't know much about living in new towns myself, but I knew that when they moved to a new town, they'd go around and introduce themselves to people. So I went across the street to the deli and introduced myself to the owner, told him I was Aubrey Hayes from Savannah, Georgia, and I just moved in the neighborhood. He looked at me kind of strange and said, "Okay." Went over to the dry cleaners next door and introduced myself to him. Went next door, there was a little bar room there. I wasn't going to drink anything that day, and introduced myself to the fellow there and told him I just moved to town. There was a little market up the street. And I went up the street doing that, and I got up the corner. I got up to the corner, and I just happened to turn around, and all these guys were hanging out the door looking just to see. I looked up this music teacher. She taught in the med building, and auditioned for her, and found out right off the bat that I didn't have the money for the lessons. She had people like Eileen Farrell and Jerome Hines and people like that, and she got like $300 an hour or something like that for lessons. And this friend of mine in Savannah had known her years and years before she got very, very prominent. But she said, every Saturday, she said, "I have a tea for all my students, and I'd like to have you come up there." And I would go up there to her apartment for tea. In a real luxurious apartment, I always wore a long formal gown. And Madame Alcock was there. She said, she would ask me to sing. And most of these people that were there, they would all sing, but I mean, she would critique each one of them, you know. But she asked me right along with the ones who were her paying students. And a lot of them had won med auditions of the air and things like that. She was a real kind lady. But I got to where I wouldn't go to those because Saturday afternoon was a good afternoon for drinking. And I would go around and make the rounds of all the different shows and audition if there were openings. And sometimes I'd make it past the first or second audition, and there'd be a final audition. And if I was drinking or hungover or something like that, I just wouldn't go. Every morning I would wake up. I don't know if y'all have ever had this experience. I'm sure you have. You're alcoholics. But every morning I'd wake up. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd swear I was going to make the rounds that day. And I wasn't going to drink. And about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd call in a couple of places and go in a couple of offices, and they'd be out to lunch, and I'd go somewhere, and I'd say, "Well, and up there, they don't want you just sitting around drinking coffee, you know, in a restaurant. If you're taking up a table or a stool or something like that, they're usually jammed at lunch, and they don't want you sitting around taking up. You cost them the money. So I'd order a beer." And that would be the last call I made that day. And I wound up from piano bars down the village. I'd go back down the village, and there were some little piano bars down there that I'd go into and sing. And one night, one of the owners there, he said, I'll tell you what, he said, there was nothing much going on. He said, if you go up there and sing a few songs and start people sing, he said, I'll give you $5 and I'll pick up your tab. Sounds like a good deal to me. So I did, and I wound up fairly drunk that night, and I said, I wonder if this will work in some of these other places. I wound up with about 5 of those little places I'd go into a night or two a week. Because when you start people singing around those piano boards, they stay, and they spend money. And it was a good deal for the people that owned it. It was a good deal for me. And I wound up, make a long story short, staying drunk 2 years up there like that. Accomplished nothing. Feeling worse and worse about myself because I'd already gotten to the point where I thought that to overcome all the mistakes I'd made in my life, I was going to have to do something grand and glorious, you know, to make up for it. I was going to have to be a star, you know, to the point that when I came back to Savannah, they'd have a ticker tape parade or something, you know. And this would all go through my mind, you know, while I'm drinking, and it all made sense at the time, you know, when it was high. But anyway, I got into a fight one night with 2 or 3 guys in one of the bars. And it was just a stupid, dumb, drunk thing that I did. But 3 or 4 of these guys walked in, and they were, I didn't have a sense to know at the time, but they were kind of tough. And there was a good looking blonde lady with them, but she was very heavy. And she got up and sang with this piano player, and she had the most gorgeous voice I ever heard in my life. And in my drunkenness, I walked up and told her, I said, you know, lady, if you lose some weight, you could really go somewhere and show you. And all 3 of these guys jumped me at the same time. And I was just hot-headed and hard-headed enough that I came back in after they threw me out about 3. I came back in there about 3 or 4 times, and they finally, the 4th time I came in there, they got me with a baseball bat. The bartender had sided with these guys. But I didn't find out till later that they were connected with some real tough people up there, and that I was very, very fortunate, you know, that I got out of there with nothing but a couple of barbed eyes and a busted lip. But that put me out of the music business, and I came home to Savannah. And Mom and Dad picked me up at the train and shook his head. Took me home. Mother took a look at me and screamed. And I had hair was styled in, was to wear your hair fairly long. And it also saved money from haircuts that could be used for drinking, you know. She had a barber come by my house and give me a haircut. And for a week, I was totally cut off from drinking after being drunk every night for 2 years, and you can imagine what that was like. But I didn't know enough about drinking at the time to know that that was why I was so nervous and I was so jittery. But I was pitching fits and slamming the walls with my fist and things like this, and so they decided I should go to see a psychiatrist. So I went to see the psychiatrist, and the first thing he asked me was, how much do you drink? And I gave him the answer that's been given by thousands of alcoholics for hundreds of years, you know, just a couple of beers, you know. He said, well, why do you drink? And I said, well, all my friends drink, and we have a good time drinking. I don't see anything wrong with it. My folks are teetotalers. They belong to my mother's and the Mormon's Christian Temperance Society. She's been here all her life. And my grandmother too, but I said, I don't see anything wrong with it. He said, I don't either. He said, if you can handle it. He said, can you handle it? I said, I don't have any problems with it. He said, well, you folks are concerned. He said, have you ever heard of AA? And I said, yeah, I heard of it. I had heard of it. I heard of it in New York, in a bar. I was sitting on a bar stool, and a guy came in. It was almost a derelict. And he was a loud talking guy, but for some reason or other, even though he was unshaven and just a mess physically, he got a lot of respect from the people in there. And I asked one of the people in there that I knew, I said, who is that? And they said, you. He said, that's Lee Dixon. I said, who is Lee Dixon? He said, man, he was the star of Oklahoma. He said, he got more rave reviews than Alfred Drake. He said, he was in it for years. And I said, what happened? He said, oh, said he got a bad marriage or something, and said he started drinking, and said he's been like that ever since. And anyway, one night when I was in there, I just, you know how it is when you're when you're about half high, you have authority on everything. And I said to the fellow, I said, how come you don't quit drinking and get back in shape and get back in show business? And he said, oh, he said, I've given up on that. He said, my legs are gone. He said, I can't dance anymore. He had taught Dan Daly and Gene Kelly. He was their teacher in choreography. I mean, that's how big a guy he'd been. And I said, what did you do to try to quit? And he said, I've tried a lot of things. He said, one of the things I tried was AA. And I said, what's that? He said, oh, he said, those are the best people in the world. He said, I couldn't make that program, but he said, they really helped me. He said, if anybody said anything bad against those people, he said, I'd get up right now and see if I couldn't whip them in the shape I'm in. And I said, well, they must be good folks. He said, have you ever heard their prayer? And I said, no. And he said, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And there's two or three of us old drunks sitting and crowded around in there, and we said, that's the most beautiful thing we ever heard. Oh, we were crying. All that stuff, you know. But I said, that's the only time I ever heard of it. He said, well, they meet. He said, I'd recommend you go. He said, they meet up here. He said, the next meeting's going to be Friday night. He gave me the address up on every corner of Liberty and Savannah. So they meet upstairs over this store and said, he said, you ought to go. Well, I said, why? He said, well, he said, they drink like you and some of these other people. He said, and they help each other. Well, I had a bad habit of picturing things in my mind kind of like I want to be. What I figured it was a group of people that really liked to drink, but had gotten to the where they couldn't handle it too good anymore. And half of them stayed sober and looked after the other half that drank, and they took time about. One week it'd be one week the other. So I rang the buzzer, and it was one of the places where I rang the bell and hit this buzzer, and I went in and killed it. As I started up the steps, I heard this noise, this loud laughing. And the first thing hit my mind was, dadgummit, they've started already. They already picked up sides, and I'm probably going to be on the side that don't drink. They got up there, and I didn't see anything but coffee cups and Coca-Colas and a bunch of people laughing. I had never seen people laugh like that, just like y'all other night, except in a bar where they were swapping jokes and stories and everybody was high, you know. And so anyway, I sat there, and then the first night I went, and a fellow's up there talking, and he sounded like an old backwoods preacher. He'd slap that fan there, and he'd say, I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. And I'm thinking to myself, damn if I do either, but I sure don't say that way, you know. And he'd say, I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm so glad and thankful I'm an alcoholic. And I thought to myself, that's sicker than anybody I've ever seen in my life either. I said, they sent me here to get help by him. I said, they got to know that fella, and his name, he doesn't mind it. He's not an anonymous guy. He just don't, he uses Cornel Foy with his name. And there was a speaker at the last convention from up in Statesboro, Georgia, that knew Cornel real well. They were both with the same government office there, and he loved Cornel. I got to where I did too. I didn't understand what Cornel meant at the time and the condition I was in mentally. But what Cornel meant was that if it took me and an alcoholic to get him to AA, and if it took AA to get him into these 12 steps, and if it took the 12 steps to help him find a higher power and have a spiritual awakening, that he was glad. Now, I've since come to the same conclusion, that I would have never, ever, not as hard-headed and as rebellious and stubborn as I was, I would have never, ever found it had I not been an alcoholic. I had every opportunity. The family I was in, with my grandfather that I dearly loved, but I just couldn't follow his teachings at the time. I had to get so far down myself and had to get to the point that I just realized that by myself I couldn't do anything except cause destruction for myself and almost everybody I came in contact with, that I was willing to even listen. And when I came into AA, I was not willing to listen then. I came in for the protest. I was unhappy about being there, and I was unhappy about having to be back in my folks' house, broke. I didn't have enough sense to be grateful I had a place to stay. And I was, so as soon as I could get a job, I went back out. And so when Mother and Dad, when I finally sobered up, they said, well, you really need to go to AA, or we're going to put you away somewhere. Said, you're going to get in some serious trouble. And I was. I mean, I had a bad habit of driving cars while I was drinking. And that sort of thing. Taking dares. I wouldn't take a dare for anything. If it meant jumping off the bridge at Isle of Hope, or if it meant whatever it meant. One night, the guy bet me that I wouldn't float aboard my dad's car all the way from Savannah to Savannah Beach, which was 20 miles. And I kept it pressed to the floor the whole time. We were hitting bridges, even bridges like a Jeep or something. But this sort of thing. But it was getting dangerous. And so I went back to AA. Stayed sober about 3 months. Standing on the corner one day, and bartender from one of the bars I hung out in, was standing on the same corner. He said, "Where you been?" And I said, I've got to where I couldn't handle it. I was getting a little too much to drink, so I just decided to lay off. He said, "You know, I watched you a lot." And he said, "You know your trouble?" He said, "You drink out of a short glass." He said, "That's your trouble." He said, "You should drink out of a tall glass." He said, "You drink out of a tall glass," he said, "that way it won't hit you." He said, "Now, next time you come in, I'll fix your drinks in a tall glass." Well, that made sense to me. So just as soon as I got another check, I was at his place, and I got just as drunk. And I was sharing that with another guy that drank about like I did. And he said, "Well, you know, I always said your trouble." I said, "No." He said, "You don't eat when you drink." He said, "You don't put anything in your stomach." He said, "And I'll tell you." He said, "If you'll just eat about a half a cup of plain white rice or you drink," he said, "that'll soak up all that stuff." He said, "It won't hit your brain as quick." He said, "You'll be able to handle it." I said, "You know, it makes good sense." I sobered up after that again, and the fellow told me the next time was olive oil. Line your stomach with some olive oil. Get something on your stomach like that, you know, and that way it'll cushion, you know. And the last time that I came up with any kind of rationalization like that, it was, I said, "Well, you know, I was a PT and drill instructor in the Army at OCS. And I was in good shape. I was given 4 or 5 hours of calisthenics every day and going into Junction City and drinking all night and getting up the next day and sweating it out again." I said, "That's my trouble. I'm out of shape." Well, I'd been sober at the time about 6 or 7 months, and my dad had enough confidence in me that he put me on the road in a new car expense account. And I was down in Daytona when this new thought hit me. And so I quit. I called him and quit. And I told him, I said, "I just didn't think it was a good point to travel." I took a job teaching swimming over there at Daytona Beach YMCA for $50 a week. About one-tenth of what my dad was going to pay me. And in between swimming classes, I'd go up and work out. I'd work out and lift weights, run, jog. And I sensed I was probably stronger than I've ever been in my life, than I was in the service or any other time. And I had picked out a bar over in Daytona Beach that I was going into and drink like a gentleman. I had seen other people do it, and I was bound and determined I was going to too. And I walked in there, and it was on a Friday night. Didn't go eat dinner, and then leave. So I walked in, I ordered a martini, and asked for a menu about 7 o'clock. 10:30 that night, I'm still drinking martinis, and menus were in there, and I hadn't ordered anything. And 3 days later, these two guys from the hospital came in and picked me up off the bed and put me on a stretcher and took me to the hospital. I was so weak I couldn't get out of bed myself, couldn't move. And that's how it progressed. I didn't realize that the drinking progressed while you're sober. And if the new people that are here tonight don't ever learn but one thing from this meeting, it's going to be worth it to you. It's like the story that I heard here lately. I wish I'd heard it when I first came in here about the cucumber and the pickle. That you take a cucumber and throw it into vinegar, and at some point in time, it starts to turn into a pickle. You know when it starts to turn into a pickle, but there's one thing for sure. Once that cucumber starts to turn into a pickle, it will never be a cucumber again. And that's the same way it is once you've lapsed into alcoholism. I don't care if you stay sober as long as that guy in the big book until you make $1 million and you get all the pressure off you and you can sit back in front of the fireplace with your easy shoes on and just think you can drink. No way. Not if you're an alcoholic. And no one can tell you that you're an alcoholic except yourself. You have to go back just like I did finally and leave that denial and finally say, hey, you know, from the time I took that first drink when I was 17 years old, I've been on a downhill slide. But then I had reached a point where I couldn't quit. I got to the point where I couldn't quit, and I was down in St. Petersburg. I'd gone through several jobs. One of the things I figured, well, you know, along with my drinking, one of the things I used to chase women a lot. And a lot of times if I had a girl I liked, I'd go in a bar. Then when I was trying to stay on the wagon and I drank Coca-Cola for a while or something like that, next thing you know, I'd start drinking again. I said, well, you know, if I can eliminate this business about the women, maybe I can stay sober. So I figured, well, maybe I should get married. So the first one didn't take, but then I got married again, and it still didn't work 100%, but it worked a little bit better. But the only problem was that I was taking another person down, and then after my little girl was born, I was taking two more people down when I'd get on these benders. Well, I was down in St. Petersburg, had a job, been sober a while, and she was back home living with her folks, and her dad hated my guts because I had taken the apple of his eye and married a drunk and did not support her and let back help him with my baby. And I thought he was just narrow-minded, selfish, you know, and old grouch, you know, no sense of humor at all. But I'm down there working and I get on this bender again, but this time I had stopped for driving under influence, and it was a fourth offense. Strangely enough, I wasn't drunk, but I was drinking. And the cops were a little bit rougher on me than they could because I had tried to insist that I wasn't drunk. And anyway, I wound up out of jail on bond, hungover, had about $15 in my pocket, left, and my wife was divorcing me and taking my little girl, and I lost my job, and I made on reports for 3 weeks. And that was when I finally, I said, well, you know, I think I'll go across the liquor store across the street from the apartment. The landlady was going to put me in jail for defrauding the innkeeper, but I hadn't paid rent in 2 months. And I promised her pretty good that I would, but I didn't, and she got mad. She was a real unreasonable person, too, and very not very understanding. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe I better go over there and take this $15 and get 2 or 3 bottles of cheap liquor and come back here and figure this thing out. And Simpson told me, if you do, you're going to go down the tubes, that you've been lucky. Because I've been going into these detoxes and private little sanitariums, and at the time my folks had sent me to Silver Hill at one time, 3 months up there. That's where Joan Kennedy went when she sobered up. Really expensive place. And I think I lasted 10 days after I got out of there. Some of the times I would get drunk on the way back. But my dad and I sat out in later years one time, and he said, how many of those places did we put you in here? I said, I don't know. We went back, and he had a separate file. And we counted the canceled checks. As close as we could tell, I was in 51 of them, detoxes and four or five of the long-term treatment centers. And there were detoxes. There were Dr. Mills and Santa Terry and Jackson. I was in 11 times when I was living in Ponte Vedra, of course, time there. So I've been through all of that. Mother and Dad at that time and had some financial reverses. They couldn't help me. Nobody could help me. I was broke, and I was going to jail for that fourth DUI. And I knew that if I went and took that money and spent it on liquor, that it was just down. It was asylums, jails, prison farms, or whatever. And I started digging around to see if I could find my big book. I had a big book that I'd gotten when I was in the Marion County Jail one time for DUI. And the sheriff came back one time, sitting back there. I said, you know, Sheriff, I've been trying to stay in AA, stay sober, and said I had a slip. So I believe if I could get out of here and get back to AA, I believe I'd be okay. He said, you got a big book? And I said, no. He said, just a minute, I'll get you one. And he went up in the front, brought me a big book, and on the front page it had his name, property of F.L. McGahee. He said, son, don't try to give me no more BS. He said, I've been sober 7 years. He said, I was in this jail over 100 times, he said, myself. And he said, when I got sober, he said, after I'd been sober a while, I said, I ran for sheriff and said, he said, I'll help you all I can, but he said, don't try to con me. You know, about what you got anymore. He said, read that big book. When you finish reading that big book and can answer a few questions about it, he said, I'll let you out. When I left, he gave it to me and left it. It's the first edition. It's the 13th printing, but it's the first edition. I still have it and value it very much. But anyway, I found that. And I went back in it, and I started reading about this fellow who beat up the nurses and DTs and who had all these terrible things happen to him. Bob Bill came in and started talking about God. And a while back, he accepted God, and he never drank again. And I fell forward on my face, and I said, God, if you'll give me back the peace I had when I was a little boy, and I'll do anything you want me to, but you've got to take away this compulsion to drink, because I simply can't quit. When it hits me, I can't quit. And I stayed on my face for about, I don't know how long, and I pulled myself to my knees and began to cry. And I don't know how long I stayed on my knees, but it was something like water pouring on me. And when I got up, I don't know why, but even all the trouble I was in, I felt like everything was going to be okay. And that night I slept like a baby. I had called AA that night, and they didn't come. They always came. I always used to use them to help me sober up. But they didn't come that time, the first time. Next morning, a guy knocked on the door, and it was a guy from AA. He said, I'm sorry we missed up last night, mixed up your message, but he said, I'm here now. Anything I can do to help you? And I said, yep. I said, my check's in Bradenton, my car's in a pound, and I'm here. He said, let's go to Bradenton and get your check and get your car out of pound. So we went. And anyway, this whole series of miracles happened. There was even a mistrial in the DUI. And after about 6 months, I came over to Orlando about the Old Court Street Club Room, 3 months later. This was in 63. The Old Court Street Club Room when it was down there, and stayed here about 3 or 4 months sober. And after about 6 months, all of a sudden, it dawned on me that I had no compulsion to drink. And it's been that way for, well, this will be 33 years since I prayed that prayer. And if I don't have any message at all to give to anybody, it's that the higher power, God, I call him, God as I understand him, he answers prayer. If you sincerely mean it, not just get me over this one, God, and I'll get over the next one myself type of thing, you know what I mean, but you sincerely mean it, he will answer prayer. And then the steps will help. The big book says we think that a man's unthinking who feels that sobriety is enough. I used to think if I could get sober a year, I'd be okay. My sponsor used to tell me, stay sober a year, you get walking around sense. I stayed sober a year, and he moved it up to 2. And stayed 2, and he moved it to 5. It took me, I had done myself so much damage at such an rate, I had no good habits. I had none. But through the years, through working on these steps, and through not just taking an inventory and saying, hey, that's it, but I've gone back. People that know me know I've gone back, and I've done many searching in fearless moral inventory. Some people say, well, 10 steps, the same thing. It ain't the same thing to me, because I go back and I do the whole thing over again, and I find some old bones in there that I didn't know were there. And people that know me, like you're talking about people in the board meeting, people that know me that get these business meetings with me, they know I still got character defects. I still got a bad temper. And I still like to control. And I still like to do all these different things. And I've laid those on the altar. Every time I do that seventh step, I say, hey, God, take these things. And they get less and less and less. I don't know. That controlling business is something that a lot of alcoholics have a bad habit. You know, we want to control other people, but once they agree to be controlled, then we don't know what to do, you know. But Grace on the Fire, you know, Grace on the Fire, she's a recovering alcoholic, and she just broke up in a relationship with her boyfriend, and her friend that she's telling about it says, well, I said, you know, Grace said, you are kind of controlling. And she said, well, it's not that I'm controlling, it's just that I'm the only one who always knows what to do. But I'm here to tell you that that is a defect of character. And it's one that I have prayed to have lifted from me. My temper is not nearly as bad. I still throw birds in traffic. Some people. But I don't follow them off the exit ramps and chase them down. Like I used to. Things are getting better, and if I stay here long enough, maybe I'll be the kind of person that I really should be. But I'm sober today, and I'm so much better off than I was before. And I'll be eternally grateful to the higher power for taking two old drunks up there in Akron, Ohio, and showing them a way of life. I was reading the thing. I'll say this, and then I'll close. There's a verse in the Bible that said, God chooses the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. And he takes the weak things of this world to confound the strong. And if there's anything any more weak and foolish than a practicing alcoholic, I don't know what it is. And yet he took a fellow, Bill Wilson, who was evidently mostly talk. He'd been living off his in-laws and his wife and everything like that for years. And there's old Dr. Bob. He's almost been, they don't want to call it disbarred for a doctor, but he's having a hard time making a living in a practice because he's gotten around to be. And that takes those two old guys at their kitchen table in Akron, Ohio, and from there, this program has done things that the smartest psychiatrist have been unable to do, unless they're alcoholic psychiatrists. They just simply haven't been able to help. And they've helped the narcotics addicts, they've helped the overeaters, they've helped the sex addicts, the gamblers, and anonymous, and all the others, those 12 steps that came out of that meeting. And when I read that verse the other day, those verses, they came out and I said, you know, that's really what happened. He took those two old foolish things, a weak and foolish guy, and made something out of it that must really have some of these smarter people shaking their heads and saying, we don't know how it works. I don't know how it works either. I really don't. I just know it does. I know if you don't drink and you go to meetings and you work the steps, you'll have a happy life. Thank you so much.
Thank you.